Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. And today we get the pleasure of speaking and interviewing Sharon Vosmek. She is CEO and managing partner of Astia, and I'm sure we'll learn more about that. But just as a highlight, in my own words, they invest in the venture capital space, specifically around the opportunities as well as gaps relating to gender and racial inclusion. In addition, I've heard you describe this yourself this way, and I'm assuming it'll come through. You are an economist.
Doing my best to wear an investor hat as an economist. Very interesting mix.
Very, very much. Well, I can't wait to dig in. And one last comment. If you want to see one of the most diverse and interesting resumes on LinkedIn, go check out Sharon's. I was looking at it today and I'm like, more experiences. So welcome and thanks for joining us.
So good to be joining you in this conversation. I love your notion of impact investing themes broadly, and I've really enjoyed getting to know your thoughts about it.
Well, you will give our listeners, I know, food for thought, and I love specifically the area of focus that you're in. But before we get into that, give us a little background of yourself, maybe where you grew up, when you went to school, and then just a high level of your career.
You know, interestingly, my life, as you rightly point out on LinkedIn, has been a fairly serendipitous journey, but it is grounded very much in values. And why that matters is I do believe investment as a force for change. And I do believe it comes right out of my origin story. I was a daughter of a doctor and nurse, husband and wife team, who did famine relief in Ethiopia as my youngest experience in life. And I think that one cannot help but be impacted by the choices my parents made as medical professionals to serve not only medicine, but really their values by choosing to serve medicine in a rural context within a famine-ridden country like Ethiopia.
Now, did you live there at the time?
Yeah. So my youngest years were in Ethiopia. My first memories are Ethiopian. My home food is Ethiopian. I know you're looking at me saying, oh, that's a nice Midwestern girl from Wisconsin, which I am. But my very first memories, I moved there at 6 months old, and then we moved back when I started school.
So you talk about values. What values or what drove your parents to go to Ethiopia to practice their trade?
Yeah. And you know, I've heard the family story from many different lenses, but this is my truth about the family origin. And that was really that my father came from a place of privilege and my mother did not. And I think they chose each other each for that dichotomy. And Ethiopia was an alignment of their values coming from very different backgrounds. And what I mean by alignment of their values, you can practice medicine in a lot of ways, right? You can choose to be a doctor in all sorts of ways. But what they cared about first and foremost was this notion of being part of humanity and leaving humanity better than when you started there. And certainly their work had, I'm going to use the word missionary, small m, had a missionary component. It was very much about sharing their culture and values with others through their medical work. To some degree, it was Christian, and to some degree, it was just Joe Vosmek and Barbara Vosmek values. The humanity. There are people suffering. They needed to go and be a part of that. What I would say is they also believe strongly in family. And when you link humanity and family, you tend to take actions that are very intentional. You don't leave things to accident because you don't want to harm. And you want to live by the medical creed of do no harm. And I think that was my parents very much. And certainly as a young child, I grew up understanding that I was of this world. And so I had obligations to this world. That's the best way I can describe it.
You must have said that once or twice before, because that was very articulate.
I'd been asked it before, but never from an impact investing theme. So
oh,
that
really?
Was a, yeah, that was me reflecting on it. I mean, to me, I've always lived it. So it's very authentic to be able to talk about it, but no one as from an investment through this entire journey of this specific conversation with you, I've not been asked it that way.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So then your parents came back to the U.S., I'm assuming?
Yes.
So how old were you when that?
I started kindergarten in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And then we moved to Honduras shortly after.
Okay. I didn't realize this is getting better.
Yeah. No, it's my life's journey, right? So Honduras and Thailand came later after that. And what I'll do is I'll encapsulate my youth as I am from Wisconsin, but I wasn't born and raised there.
All right. Can you tell us the places you've lived then?
Sure. I was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Actually, my parents were living on the Navajo Nation. I grew up then earliest years in Wallo Province, Ethiopia, then moved to Wisconsin for a few years, lived in Pinalejo, Honduras, and then for a short time, my father lived in Thailand. We only visited because I was in high school at the time. And that was northern Thailand and outside of Chiang Mai in a refugee camp for the Hmong refugees. It was my last years of high school and beginning of college that my dad moved back to Ethiopia. So while I have not subsequently lived back in Ethiopia, my father did. And those places were always part of our lives.
Okay. I feel like a schmuck. I mean, I've moved around, but it's all been in the United States. So is there one or two things that you could share that living in that diversity has, bred into you or that has changed you?
You hear me, Jeff, because we've been getting to know each other, talk about inclusion. And I think a lot of people can empathize with why inclusion matters. But it really takes being in a minority group to understand actionable inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so growing up in places like Ethiopia, Honduras, Thailand, even Wisconsin, by the time I moved to Wisconsin, I was definitely an outsider, even though I could fit in very well because of my skin and where my parents had lived there. I was not from there. And so I think being that outsider really gave me a call to action around inclusion. I'm not going to wait for someone else to figure it out. I have an obligation, and not just an obligation, I have a desire. I've benefited hugely from others welcoming me in when I've been an outsider. I have benefited so generously from entire communities who have allowed me to become family with them. We didn't just visit these places, we lived in these places. And when you live in a place where you're not in the majority, there's a real humbling that happens, and I think a real understanding of intentional inclusion.
Yeah, I don't want to put words in your mouth. So when I hear that, one of the things I hear is some people in the impact space, whatever the theme is, whatever, it could be checking the box. For you, it's clearly, there's a checking the box, which means that you're getting it done. But for you, it's not the box checking. It's the desire and the heart because you believe in it. Whether the box gets checked and anybody sees it or not isn't the point.
And it not just makes me a better person. You know, it's not even about that. It's I am a more vibrant human being because I have that experience, right? I do like the experience set of inclusion too. I think some people truly struggle with inclusion. Inclusion's uncomfortable. It's kind of messy. There are people who will disagree with you, who you love and adore.
Yeah.
Who you live with, and they will have experienced the world differently than you. You know, true inclusion is really messy stuff, and it's hugely uncomfortable. What I notice is that too many organizations and people are looking for inclusion to be comfortable. We all need to feel included and safe and warm. Mm-hmm. And actually, real inclusion is getting comfortable with uncomfortable. And the more you can embrace that discomfort, mm-hmm. the more vibrant your life. And that's I think, what I mean when I think about inclusion. It's the vibrancy of idea and thought and people.
No, I love that because as I transitioned from the traditional finance world as well as way of thinking, what I have been shocked is that I would argue I have seen an increased level of creativity and innovation in the impact space. And I think part of that is because you not only, yes, you engage your brain and frankly, you broaden what success looks like. So it's not just financial, it's others. But then this is the part where people get a little bit queasy when I say this, you're actually engaging the heart as well. And then it just changes the dynamics. And, you know, you say that and people go, oh, no, let's just, this is all about making money. And you're like, no, you can bring heart into this. It's okay.
And you can bring heart, you can bring your values. You know, I've been an early stage investor since 1995, you know, long enough to know there's optionality with everything we do, but specifically with investment, there's a lot of optionality. There are a lot of deals to be done. And I happen to choose to do deals that I feel good about, right? There are a lot of deals to choose from. And I just, you know, I passed on deals that people made a lot of money on, but I've done deals where I've made a lot of money. And when given the choice, if I'm going to make a lot of money, I want to do it with my heart right there with it. It just isn't the same the other way.
Yeah. One of the things I talk about is when you invest and you try to keep your heart and your emotions out of it, because that's what everybody tells you, it's fear and greed. You just grip onto everything so tight. And unfortunately, naturally, fear and greed comes in. When you actually open your hands a little bit, invest not only for your values, but then how that capital is impacting others. By loosening your grip, you actually allow some joy and freedom into what you just said. And it's the same thing that I've experienced the last 6 years. It is so much richer than what I used to do. And there's nothing wrong with what I used to do. I didn't do anything morally wrong. But I'm telling you, when you can engage your head and your heart on this, I'll do it all day long.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that I'm an economist. I also bring with me that lens as well, right? That I actually think today's greatest challenge, like we are more interconnected than we've ever been before. And we see the results of interconnectedness with climate crisis. We see interconnectedness having an adverse impact on health with the pandemic. We see that our interconnectedness and its implications as it relates to the internet having good and bad outcomes. And what I'm aware of is when I lead with my values in my investing, my investments tend to be making a positive contribution towards those issues that are real world issues. And that wasn't that I set out to be an investor in the climate space or in the pandemic space or in the, it was that I started with my heart, which is I believe in inclusion as a fundamental for everything I do, including investment. Mm-hmm. And therefore the outcome becomes these real world outcomes that are quite exciting and do have a climate impact and do have a humanity impact. Anyway, I've never considered myself an impact investor until very recently when the language of impact investing, I think, evolved post George Floyd, I'll be honest, to start talking about inclusion as a part of impact. It's interesting. I think that it was always there. It just wasn't in the language for me to have aligned with it. And now I align with it because I see the language there.
Interesting. So I'm curious. So when I think about impact investing, I've talked about it as a two-sided coin. I actually could make that even more, but for simplicity's sake. So on one side is people are trying to solve real environmental, social issues. On the other side of that coin, I would say it's more about aligning of values. I actually came at this probably more from aligning of values. The two go hand in hand. Does one of those resonate more with you, or is it kind of equal? It's the values alignment as well as solving issues.
Well, the dirty little secret about me and impact investing as a category is that up until 2 years ago, I said I was not an impact investor.
And why would you say you were not an impact investor?
There were a few things in my journey as an investor that reinforced it. So I attended a conference that I spoke at. I was the only panelist on the panel who had a portfolio. The rest were talking about the investments they would do.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel like money was really flowing. The other thing that happened is they were predominantly white conferences. And I struggle with male-only conferences, add to it race, and I just go nuts. And so I had, you know, I had my own biases about what an impactor investor looked like, and it just didn't look like me and didn't sound like me. Like I said, I feel in the last 2 years that has shifted pretty dramatically. And more I'm finding conversations like this, Jeff, quite honestly, these are new for me. No one has ever consulted me as an impact investor. And I've been investing, as I said, for 25 years.
Interesting.
Except for that one panel. And the only reason I was on that one panel was because of my gender discussion, right? I know all the data around where women in entrepreneurship are and where investors are not investing. So
before we go on, describe for us what you currently do in your work and what are you fired up at from an investment perspective? So at least we can get a little more context.
Well, and if I could back up a little bit about not only what I do, but how I got to what I do.
Sure.
So let me, it's a very short story, but it matters. So I was studying women's participation in the economy globally. I was working for a US senator first. It became very clear to me in looking at the US that women were not equal to men. And I went back to graduate school to really look at, were there economies around the world where women were? And what did they look like? What did they take? It's along that journey that I, right after graduate school, met the founder of Astia. And it was only then that I learned about venture capital. I knew nothing about venture capital and quite honestly would not have found it interesting, but for the fact that when I met the founder of Astia, she said something to me that just tipped my curiosity. She said that 1.2% of venture capital was invested into women CEOs. And I, as an economist, as a student, as an academic, could not imagine a more distorted economy. There could be no way that this was an efficient and functioning economy if only 1.2% was going to women. I knew enough about women's participation in agrarian economies, in more developed economies, and I knew that for societies to function at their optimal, you could not have that kind of distortion. And add to it the layer that I had learned very quickly when I started learning about venture capital, that it was, in the last 30 years, the creator of all net new jobs. So the job creation and wealth creation that venture was doing and seeing was excluding 52% of the population. I just couldn't fathom. There was no math that could lead to that kind of distortion in the market. So it became a very curious academic exercise to see what were the elements at play that were causing this kind of distortion. What I also knew, having studied women's participation in economy, that there were some very successful models. We knew that Muhammad Yunus had in microlending had done a phenomenal job of addressing asset and wealth disparities between genders. We knew that women within economies could be a better bet or as good a bet as men. So we knew some things about women's performance within economies. And what has been really exciting for me at Asti is I've been able to stay around long enough to really hone my craft and become a bit of an expert on women within this part of the economy. Sadly, we're still only at 2% of venture capital being invested in women.
Wow.
But we are a lot further in understanding the consequences. And let me give you just some.
Yeah. Give me some. Yeah, I'd love to hear that.
The consequences are that all the work that we do around diversity and inclusion that sits within corporate America cannot move the bar for wealth creation, power accumulation, and influence nearly as compared to entrepreneurship. What I mean by this, if you start a business, from day one, you are an executive. From day one, you're on the board. From day one, you have the potential to move your assets from nothing to something, because you have shares in your company, you have wealth. Then if that company goes on to actually successfully raise capital and have a subsequent event, it is the fastest path to wealth creation. And if we exclude women from this path, we see a 6 to 12% impact to GDP. And what I mean by that is a negative impact. So in other words, if we unleashed and invested in women commensurate with their male counterparts, we would actually see this 6 to 12% increase in GDP. That's what I mean by impacts. There are no other levers within the economy that you could tweak to get a 6 to 12% change in GDP.
Why don't we know those numbers? I mean, I don't know those numbers.
Honestly, because I think, well, I told you I was an economist. I like reading stupid stuff. And by stupid stuff, I just mean dry stuff.
Right,
I mean
right.
Stuff that, you know. And also, what's interesting is we do know it when women are actually at the table. Let me tell you a good example. The reason I know that 6 to 12% number is that when Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton, was Secretary of State, she commissioned a body to look at the impact to GDP of women's participation or lack thereof. Having a woman at the table enabled the question to be asked. Prior to that, we had just never asked. So bless her for doing that work. I was a part of her entrepreneurial, she had an entrepreneurial commission. I can't remember, it had a really great officious title, but it was in participating completely as a person. Once again, I'm an investor, but I lead with my values. So I participated completely when invited to something that had nothing to do with my investment activity, had everything to do with understanding better the landscape for women, it was then that I learned some of these factoids that I hold on to and remind myself, this is why I do the work, because there's this opportunity to have a positive impact for the economy. There's a positive impact for society. There's a phenomenal impact for innovation. And there is an opportunity to move people from where they are to a position of power, equity, and influence within one generation. Nothing else does it like entrepreneurship.
You make a very compelling case. So now, give us a little bit. I mean, you've already given us, obviously an insight into Astia, but give us maybe just a little bit more without getting into any regulatory stuff. Just, what do you guys do?
So Astia at its core is a nonprofit organization founded 20 years in Silicon Valley to address that dearth of funding that was going into companies led by women. I should highlight that we were founded out of the ashes of Cisco, even though Cisco's a very successful business. Right. But if you don't know the founding story, there were some charred feathers, wings clipped, as it were. Sandra Lerner was the founder, and she was fired unceremoniously by her investors for being too difficult to manage. Her peers, I like to always highlight that her peers are Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and Larry Ellison, three of the easiest going men, and they were never fired by their investors for being too difficult.
Right.
But she was too difficult, so she had to go. And Kate Muther, our founder, had been at Cisco at that time and experienced that and looked around Silicon Valley. And with a real intentionality, launched Astia as a program, first an incubator program. And then over the years, we have evolved into other models. We went from incubator to accelerator. And today we are still an accelerator model. We connect entrepreneurs with an advisor community. And then in addition, under that, we have a number of investment programs that enable individuals within our community to continue to participate in our work, aligning our mission, both of that access and the investment side by side.
I gotta ask this question because this oftentimes gets confused in this space. You said nonprofit and you all invest to make money?
We do. So we are a nonprofit that invests. There are a few models. There are a few out there like us. Common Fund is another one.
Sure.
But we exist first and foremost, very much committed to ensuring access to capital for companies that include women. That is our mission. Well, what's the best way to achieve that? It's not to mentor them, it's not to coach them, and it's not to sponsor them. The best way to achieve our mission is to write the check. And we, in our early days, believed that VCs would take a look at our companies we found and invest in them. And we wouldn't need to be investors. But after 10 years of doing our work, and not only not seeing the market move, but seeing it basically unbudgeable, we figured out that if we hosted our own investment activity, we wrote that check, we could better serve our mission. So the management fee and carry from our investment activity fuels the connections of our entrepreneurs to the broader 5,000 community members that Astia represents. And it's that access that ensures their success well beyond the capital.
All right. Well, I'm going to jump to a question in light of what you just said. You don't have to answer it in congruency to what you just were talking about, but I'm curious. When did you realize the power of capital and what does that mean to you, I guess?
I'm an economist, so I was slow to it. So we, every year, do strategic planning with our board and our executive team. By the way, this makes us better investors, and more investors should have board of directors. That's my quick pitch for board governance. Having said that, every year, strategic planning. And at our 10-year anniversary, we took a look at had we moved the market, because that's, as a nonprofit, your work is to move the market. And not only had we not moved it, we had found some of the best in class companies. Like the companies that went through Astia were, when we modeled their performance, were outperforming VCs hand over fist. But no one was writing checks to them. They were forced to grow based upon customer traction. And then I'd call it very creative fundraising. A whole lot of debt was used. A whole lot of family offices stepped in. I would say institutional VCs missed out, but others benefited. And really at that retreat, at the 10-year mark, we said, okay, so either we go out of business because we're not changing the world, or we acknowledge we've changed the world. It's just we've only changed it for those we touch. So how can we touch them more deeply? And the answer emerged that it was investment. And you should know that this CEO actually said, no, we shouldn't invest. But once again, this is why governance is helpful. Through that strategic planning, my eyes were open to, well, my ears were open to really that full potential.
Wait, so you were the one who said no at first?
I was. Huh. I was.
Wow. I love that honesty and humility.
Yeah. Huh. And I wrote the business case for why we should not. I showed that it would create misalignment between our entrepreneurs and our community. We considered ourselves very entrepreneurial friendly, very entrepreneur centric. And I was concerned we would lose those 5,000 advisors. That why would they continue to volunteer? Because they volunteer their time, by the way, to help these companies if we were making money as investors. So we surveyed our community. There was a 1-2 punch, which turned my head. One was our community said not only would they stay on board, they would become more deeply aligned because the companies had more potential for success because they had capital. And then number two, the second punch, when we modeled our performance and we took our accelerator model, and once again, because of regulatory purposes, I won't tell you the specific IRR, but suffice it to say, we had a really attractive investment thesis. Yeah. And when we showed that to our board, they said, you'd be fool not to turn that into an investment activity. And our golden egg today is not that we're investors, and it's certainly not that we're entrepreneur-centric. Our golden egg is that we have become experts at connecting a community in a deep, meaningful way with entrepreneurs that don't otherwise have access to that. And access is capital, access is expertise, access is customers. Access is the difference. It's what happens naturally for the white males within the innovation economy. And all we've done is set it up so that it includes women and women of color.
What's interesting is what you just described. There's a lot of people who, great people, help individuals, whether it's mentoring, whether it's whatever. But at the end of the day, somebody has to be willing to write checks. Somebody has to step up and take that risk. And the irony I would say is yes, you've got to do it smartly. But those that step up and take the risk, yes, hopefully they get the return. But the emotional values gain out of it, you can't really articulate it very well. You got to go experience it.
This is where meeting an economist helped. I had been looking at the participation of women in economies for almost 10 years by that point when we launched our investment activity. And I knew that across sectors, across geographies, across government profiles, where women participated in the economies, they succeeded. Okay, what do you mean by that? I mean, women are hugely savvy as it comes to customer acquisition, as it comes to really the fundamentals of running a business. We're running households often as businesses, and that translates well. And by the way, that's a global phenomenon. That's not speaking to just women within the US. Women globally run the household. Yep. This is a business endeavor. And so we knew, this is the little bit I was able to contribute, is that we knew that just by the nature of these businesses having women, they were going to perform differently than their male-only counterparts. And by the way, when I say that 2% is invested into women CEOs, 98% of the other are male-only teams, male-only. So it's not even that they have women somewhere. So we're just investing in a woman somewhere because we know by adding that to the mix, if you look at businesses globally, you look at investment firms globally, where women are in the mix, the performance is enhanced.
Let me ask you a hard question, and I'm not trying to pin you, but it's a question that I always think about in these contexts. What is the right number, or what would be the right range where you said, yeah, I think we got it right?
This comes to quotas. I always like to say, I hate quotas. I love the results. Find me something better and I'll do it. So I'm actually a believer in counting. Thank you for asking. When half of the venture dollars are invested into women CEOs, we've got the right number. I mean, that's just the truth. It just purely mathematically. Now, am I going to hold my breath until that happens? No, because I also know that asset accumulation has been happening in, you know, post-industrial revolution. How asset accumulation has broken down is by race and gender. So I got a lot stacked up against me. But I mean, that's the simple and right answer. There is nothing genetically different between men and women that would mean that the number shouldn't be that.
Do you see, again, not trying to be a jerk about this, do you believe that, whatever, there's 100 entrepreneurs, do you believe that there truly are 50 women who want to be entrepreneurs just as there's 50 men who want to be entrepreneurs? Does that?
Nope. The numbers are not equal because we socialize women differently than men. So they have different entrepreneurial phenotypes is what I like to say. Okay. And often women are growing businesses that aren't right for venture backing, right? They're phenomenal businesses that employ people and drive economic growth, but they're not venture backable. But we do socialize young men to take that moonshot, right? And so no, there are more men than women in high growth entrepreneurship. But does that mean that it shouldn't be 50-50? I still stand comfortably with my 50% number because not all high growth entrepreneurs receive funding. And the women who are there certainly deserve funding as much as their male counterparts. And that does get you to the 50-50. So if 1,200 venture deals are done each year, there is no defense that there aren't 600 women to invest in. It's just not true. If it were that there was a limited set of entrepreneurs commensurate with a limited pool of capital, then maybe the percentage would be different. But we're not talking about that. We're talking an abundance of entrepreneurs and a limited pool of capital. So why wouldn't it be 50-50? And by the way, I'm not making the case for 50-50 because they're women. I'm actually saying just mathematically, there's no reason that it wouldn't be that women have been half the college graduates for the last 30 years. We are more than half the PhDs. And we are commensurate within law, MBA, and medical programs in a way. By commensurate, I mean our performance within colleges, we've been commensurate with men for more than 30 years. So the numbers have to be there for at least 600 women to be venture backable. It just mathematically.
All right. This may be a self-evident question, but because I see it, but I'm going to give you freedom to answer. How are you trying to change the world?
Oh, love the question. I see investment as a force for change. Whatever change it is you seek. Mm-hmm. I seek a more sustainable planet. I seek a global population that has access to healthcare. I seek a dynamic between peoples that enables more democratic values, small d. These are the things I seek, and I believe investment can be aligned with those values to achieve my goals, both as it relates to changing the world broadly and changing the world specifically.
You know, there's some discussion in this broader impact space where is this socialism? Is it, you know, capitalism? I mean, I think I hear you squarely saying that capitalism, while albeit may not be perfect as you're mentioning, is probably where you would fall.
Yeah. So capitalism with guardrails works really well. It's a phenomenal system. But once again, I'm an economist. If you look at the origins of capitalism, it's always had a requirement for guardrails, right? When we allow it to run free, it has never performed for humanity. But when simple guardrails are put in place, and for me, my guardrails happen to be my values. And a great example is I'm a beneficiary of two valve replacements. The humans who created the innovation that enabled me to survive not one, but two replacements of my original heart valve, that is brilliance at the scientific level combined with capitalism at the innovation level. The team at CryoLife that got venture funding and grew and went through clinical trials that ultimately put their valve in my heart are hugely part of my thinking. As an investor, I value them. I believe in them. I invest in them. Did I donate to the company? No. Do I believe in charity? Absolutely. Did they need charity? No. They were part of this capitalist system. Mm-hmm. Now, is that an impact investment? Would be my question to you. I don't know, but you have to tell me.
Well, I would, again, there is a grayness to this, but for me personally, I would call that an impact investment. I absolutely would. We could probably dissect why that is. I want to make one comment, though, because one of the things when I left traditional finance to go to impact investing, I didn't broadly broadcast this, but one of the messages that I felt like was true and still is true today was, and it's going to sound arrogant, so take it in the smaller than what it sounds, but I really want to try to help redeem capitalism. You know, because I think capitalism, I believe in it 100%. But to your point, I think it's gone off its rails a little bit. And it's frankly more people than anything. And so, you know, I don't take capitalism bigger than what it is, but I do think we need to redeem it. I think you look at any technology, look at anything, it can go off tracks. You know, you look at Facebook. I mean, on one level, Facebook is an amazing what they provide. On the other hand, if not monitored, it goes down a track that probably not good. And so rather than throw the baby out of the bathwater, it's like, okay, how do you redeem this for good? Now, I think the real question in this whole stuff is, what do you define as good? What do I define as good?
But there are universal goods. That's the interesting thing. So, you know, my heart valve, I was born with a defective valve. I didn't do anything to destroy my body. I wasn't misbehaving. I, you know, wasn't smoking. I was born with a defective valve. I needed a valve. I think the universal good is, if there's a valve to be put into my chest, let's put it in. That was best achieved through the initial investment that was made, but probably by the National Science, I think it was. The NSF invested early on. I actually don't know. I should go back and study the history of that company, but I can only assume that there were grants at the early stages, followed by venture capital, followed by the public markets that accepted these things. Now, I've lived in places where capitalism is not a thriving thing. I've lived in Honduras. I've lived in, oh my goodness, when we were in Ethiopia, we got kicked out because Haile Selassie didn't like that my dad took down his photo, his picture from his exam room. So I've been in places where democracy and capitalism have not been the norm. My observation is that when capitalism functions at its best and most beautiful, it aligns with humanity rather than this distorted misalignment that we tend to see when it's driven by risk and greed. And I think what's beautiful about bringing women and people of color into the investment landscape, making it a more inclusive investment landscape, is their life experiences make investment better. They make us all better.
Sure.
Right? We understand the world from a different experience set. It just makes it better. So I think that there's a place for philanthropy. I think that there's a reason to donate to charities, but I think you can align those with your investments.
I agree with you. I think, though, there is a little bit of a utopian to think that nonprofits can solve a lot of these problems. I think they're needed. But if you look where the capital is today, it's in business. And so harnessing that for good, I think, is critical. Last two questions. Stewardship. Any thoughts on what stewardship means to you?
I learned the truism that you just said, that nonprofits can't solve everything. And Astia's journey to what we are today, this hybrid model, I think makes us a better place. In light of that, I do feel an obligation of stewardship. I don't feel that anything we've built at our organization is because of Sharon Bosmick. It has been the marshaling of a community. It has been marshaling of an understanding, the learnings, the education. And it is our obligation then to be stewards of. And I don't know if this is exactly where you're going, but I certainly feel the obligation of stewardship. It's one of the reasons I believe in governance. I think we are better stewards when the sunlight is shown in on the work we're doing. And so I think as both as a nonprofit and as investors, we're not the best, but we are darn good because we're still working to be the best. I think we will be the best when we're closer to that 50% number and others are following us. But we are absolutely committed to working to being the best and being good stewards of the generosity and resources we've received along our journey. But you know, one other thing about stewardship is it takes intentionality. Back to this intentional thing. I think where things run amok in the investment landscape, in capitalism, in this kind of work, is when we're not intentional about the components. And the components are stewardship. The components are, for us, we align values and enact values into the work we do.
I do love the way that you constantly refer to values. On our website, when we started 5 years ago, we actually didn't even have the word impact investing because we viewed it more as values. The vernacular, we've probably changed just as I think impact is becoming more the term. But just a comment, I I love the way you talk about values, because I think they're critical. I think it's what drives a business. I think it gives us a North Star. And I think it's really important. All right. And I can guess what one of your dreams is, but if you could pick a dream, and I always have to preface this because I don't want people to go like, oh, I only got one dream. If you could pick a dream, doesn't need to be the most important, but if you could have one come true in your lifetime, what would that be?
Oh, I kind of like this question because, you know, I turned 55 this year. So dreams are suddenly, you know, if you haven't started down your path towards your dreams, you start to worry that you're getting too old to have dreams. So I, ever since I was a young girl, have believed in my ability to change things, change the world. I have a dream that at the end of this, whatever this life is, I will be able to look back and feel great reward, pride, and humility for the change I have affected. I have chosen to apply my skills and time and resources towards creating an innovation economy that includes women, not only includes women, values, embraces them, and invests in them, right? I have a dream that I will be able to look back and see that I've changed people to also value that, because change is what is required. And I would like to be able to very specifically measure and see that change.
One of the things that is very inspiring to me about you is you obviously not only have a dream, but you are passionately risking your time and capital towards that. And obviously you already are making a difference just based on, you know, the companies and that you're investing in. But I will be cheering for you and wishing you to have even greater impact in the second half of your career, which I think you're actually in a great spot. And I think the world is waking up to some of the ideas that you are espousing. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your insight. You've actually gone the longest of anybody that I've talked to, but it's because I could go on for 2 more hours. So thank you. In closing, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. Sharon, again, thank you. Anything you want to say in closing?
Oh, I just can't tell you how much I enjoyed this. This was just so generous of you, Jeff. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Getting to know people in a real way is so easy and fun for me and my listeners. So I appreciate not only taking time, but I appreciate you being vulnerable and sharing the stuff that you did.
Oh yeah, you got me to talk about my childhood. Well done.
's a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.